This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this New Books Network podcast. My name is Catriona Gold. I'm a PhD candidate at University College London. And today I'm very excited to be interviewing James Sidaway and Till Pasha about their new co-written book, Transecting Securityscapes, Dispatches from Cambodia, Iraq, and Mozambique, which is coming out in December 2021 with University of Georgia Press. James Sidaway is Professor of Political Geography at the National University of Singapore and co-editor of the Singapore Journal of Tropical Geography. Till Pasha is Associate Professor of Political Geography at Soran University, Kurdistan Region, Iraq. So welcome to the podcast, James and Till.
Thanks.
Hi, thank you.
All right, so usually I like to start by asking our authors to tell us a little bit about themselves. So perhaps we could start by hearing a little bit about your academic or maybe personal trajectory as it relates to this book, what you've worked on before now leading up to the book, and perhaps how this kind of leads you or led you to create this work. So maybe you could go first, Till.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's quite complex. Like, in a way, the new book is kind of a summary of my academic life so far. I'm German. I started my undergrad studies in Germany and then pretty soon moved to the UK for my master's and PhD because, well, political geography in Germany it wasn't really happening back then, so I moved to the UK and met James quite fast. And I was always interested in security-related issues, landmines, private military companies, private security companies. So when I was doing my PhD at Plymouth University, I was setting up my my PhD research in South Africa in 2010. And then we had this little funding available at the university or at the department, this pump funding to kick off new research. And James applied for it for Mozambique. And Mozambique is quite close to South Africa. So we kind of combined the first trip there. And then I moved on after my PhD to do a postdoc in Switzerland. We worked on security in terms of smart cities, which is very different from private military companies and landmines. Nonetheless, it's linked to security in various forms and aspects. But we kind of stayed connected, and my research for that project was in Singapore. So I visited James, we went to Cambodia, and then eventually I went to Iraq, or Kurdistan to be precise. partially because I was tired of applying for fundings. I was tired of chasing jobs that don't really exist. And I went to Iraq and they gave me money and I could do pretty much everything I wanted to do without any risk assessment and whatnot forms. I could just go places. And yeah, from there kind of things developed. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. And so you're still, yeah, you're still there now, or that's where you work at the moment, right?
No, I'm actually, it's complicated. Oh. So since,
sorry.
Since, yeah, no, it's fine. It's Iraq, right? It wouldn't be easy. My university hasn't received funding, or the Kurdistan region hasn't received funding from the federal government or the central government in Baghdad since 2014. So there hasn't been any money coming in since 2014. None of us has been paid since 2014. So I'm not there anymore since I don't get any salary. Most of the Western staff we had there has left, and Iraqi Kurdistan is still in a major crisis, which the world kind of forgot about because ISIS is gone, and everyone thinks now it's back to normal. Well, it isn't for the Kurds, so they're still struggling to survive. Yeah, as they always do in history, unfortunately. But I'm in Canada now.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. And I'm sorry to hear that as well. But I mean, I did notice that the photo on the cover of this book is you, Till. And so I assumed there was a story to be told. About that as well. But maybe we can come to that later. I'd like to. Yeah. So thank you. And what about you, James? How did you come to be writing this book? What have you worked on sort of leading up to this? I mean, that might be difficult to sum up in a nutshell, but the broad strokes.
Sure. Thank you. Probably the best way to tell the story is really to return to the moment that Till talked about, which was he'd come to Plymouth in England, where I was a prof in the geography department, and I was his co-advisor for this project on security in Johannesburg, looking at private security companies and ethnography. And this money became available, small amount of money called pump priming, that the department made available in a very straightforward application process, you know, a page, modest amount of money to do, to get some research rolling, knowing Till would already be heading down to South Africa, and having worked in Mozambique myself as a doctoral student 20 years prior to that time, we decided to add on this Till coming over to Maputo with me and make a short research visit to Maputo. So for me, it was a return to a city that I knew well from 20 years before, because I'd spent a year there, or the better part of a year there, as a doctoral student 2 decades earlier. And out of this came this idea of, well, we're here for a short time. I have good contacts in this city. It's a place I know very well. I speak the vernacular, the state language of Portuguese. What can we do in this kind of time? And given Till's interest in more longer-term ethnographic work on security, we thought, well, by what means could we perhaps do something that meaningful? We decided to do these urban transects, walking parts of Maputo that I knew very well from 20 years before, and using those as a narrative strategy to talk about security, to kind of see where this would take us. I left after that and left Till in Maputo, setting him up with a local research assistant and translator, and then Till kind of did some interviews. And so it kind of generated this idea that we can do this kind of research moving through security scapes, transecting spaces, and using this walking methodology. I'd been interested in walking methods around a literature that comes out of France and the UK, so-called psychogeography. And a couple of years earlier, I'd just written a paper about encountering geopolitics in the city of Plymouth in England, based upon a single walk through the city. So that was in our head, but we continued to kind of experiment with this this method, and we did that work in Maputo and felt that it was rewarding. It couldn't have been done, I don't think, if I didn't have that prior level of familiarity with the city. So it didn't come out of nowhere. It wasn't a first encounter with a place. However, when I moved to Singapore not too long afterwards, until I finished his doctorate and took up a postdoc in Switzerland, there was some funding available here, and I'd long been attracted by Phnom Penh as a city to think about similar themes to those that Maputo foregrounds: revolution, conflict, fast accumulation, neoliberalism, rapid transformation, post-socialism, late colonialism, empire. And there was a Khmer a postgrad in the department here in the National University of Singapore, P. Seth Keir, who could assist us and set things up for us. And together with another colleague, Chi-Wan Woon, a political geographer, faculty member here, we had a little bit of money. And because Till was over in the region already working in Singapore, we made a series of visits to Phnom Penh. And we decided we could, having used the methodology in Maputo and published one paper from it, we decided we could do something similar in Phnom Penh. It couldn't be done as quickly because we didn't have Khmer language, so we had to work through PSEF and others. But we had more time because Till was a postdoc, because we could make these repeated visits, a relative proximity of Phnom Penh to Singapore. It's just a couple of hours flights away. It meant that I could keep going back. Till could spend some extended periods there, and I think we did more interviews as well in the Phnom Penh research. In that process, we decided that we would like to add a third site. And at this time, we didn't really have the book in mind. There's some research money is available, and I had prior contacts in Kurdistan, and I'd been in Eastern Anatolia, the Turkish Kurdistan, as a student myself back in the 1980s when I was an undergrad, and I'd made a couple of visits there. Also had Kurdish contacts back in Plymouth in England, where Till and me had been, in the Kurdish refugee community there that kind of led back into Kurdistan. So kind of using those contacts, and again, relatively limited resources, we went more or less together, actually, to Kurdistan. I think, Till, you went a little bit ahead of me. And at that point, as Till already explained, he was looking for a faculty kind of tenure track position. And at that point, resources were flowing through the Kurdistan regional government. They offered him a position, so he ended up staying there. So Till's relationship with the place could become sustained. And then I made a repeat visit the following year and spent time with him there. So we repeated the kind of work that we'd done in starting out in Maputo some years earlier, and then replicating or reenacting or reworking in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, in Iraqi Kurdistan. But of course, we started doing it on a rather different scale and over a longer period because Till was living and working there, and of course, deeply engaged in the play. So a rather different relationship to the place. And in turn, that this kind of walking, transacting security escapes method, I've continued to use with others and by myself in other sites since. And we talk about that in the book. So there's a paper with a Indian grad student, Jasnia Sana, who's now a lecturer in political geography in Zurich, in Switzerland. And she was working in Myanmar, where she could speak several of the vernaculars. We went together to Yangon, where she was, and she spent an extended period there, and used the same kinds of methods with the same interests of mapping security, of encountering different forms of private and public security and insecurity in the context of a city undergoing, you know, all kinds of transformations. And so we wrote a paper together on similar themes of security and similar methods in Yangon. And in turn, just before COVID, a couple of years ago, just as we were trying to finish the book, I spent some time in Mecca, where, I mean, Mecca is a place where one does a lot of walking, you know, the Umrah and Hajj, and I did an Umrah in Mecca, is about walking. Walking as part of what one enacts as part of that that process. But of course, one does a lot of other walking. And attuned to this kind of way of thinking critically, after the Umrah was completed, I spent some time also walking and mapping different security scapes in Mecca, the same kinds of things of public and private surveillance. That work isn't written up, and it was done really to kind of see what might be possible there. And it's something that, of course, COVID then stopped, which raised a whole set of other issues about security and insecurity. So my own PhD research had been in Maputo, Mozambique, but when I went back there with Till, which is, you know, more than 10 years ago now, I hadn't been there for a good kind of 15 plus years. So after my PhD research, I went back and did some more research in Mozambique, but then I moved on to other sites. I worked in Portugal. I worked on the Portuguese-Spanish border. I worked on Portuguese geopolitics, and I started working in other sites here in Southeast Asia. So in a way, you know, this book with Till is the culmination comes out of a 3-decade-plus set of encounters, you know, that return to Maputo after 20 years with Till, and then some years after that, the work together in Phnom Penh, and then finally the work in Iraqi Kurdistan. And then a long process of writing. I mean, the long process of writing was protracted, in part because of Till's subsequent movements. But I think this is something we can come to a bit later on.
Yeah, just to follow up what James says, the original funding, the PUM primary funding from Plymouth University, it was just $3,000, and we basically did the whole research with that and wrote the environment and planning A paper. So when we later argue that the methodology is really useful also for grad students or students with limited budgets to collect data, empirical data in the field, yeah, it actually is able to do it with very little money. I just wanted to add that.
Great. Great. Yeah. Well, this is all absolutely fascinating and such a long sort of backstory, this book being the culmination of so much work. It's very impressive. I'm wondering if we could go back to that sort of theoretical and methodological question about, you know, what you're getting at in the book. So, you know, why did you feel this book was sort of necessary to write? I mean, because you did choose to write the book, obviously, after having done all these other projects. And I'm wondering, you know, what the utility is of this concept of the securityscape. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what a securityscape is, where this idea of escape comes from. I know you explained this really well in the book, so you don't have to replicate all that here, but perhaps a brief overview for our listeners would be helpful. And feel free in the process to give a shout out to any scholars or indeed non-scholars who've shaped your thinking on this.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why we kind of came back to the book, I mean, the papers were all written, the case studies, and we published it in Environment and Planning A, but we kept thinking about the idea of to write a book because we felt that, or at least I think to us, it's as much a methodology book as it is about security. We felt that we really have to say a little bit more about the methodology, tie our experiences together from the three case studies, because our methodology of transacting space, of walking, encountering space, evolved with each case study. And that didn't really come out in the paper. So we felt there's a need to actually think about it a little bit more, especially because we gotten good feedback from the papers, and the feedback from the papers wasn't just, oh, your contribution to the subject is really interesting. The feedback was also, it's a very pleasant read. Like, it's one of the feedbacks we gotten is, we read your papers and it's like we're walking through these spaces with you. And we thought there's something in there that, you know, we should promote that a little bit stronger and use the book for that. That's why this kind of transacting idea is fairly prominent in the title. We really thought we're onto something, especially when it comes, and there it links to security, but it comes to spaces that are not necessarily secure. Like, how do you research insecure spaces, possibly war zones? I wrote a couple of papers while we were working on the book on working in conflict zones with journalists, etc. So we really thought there's something there we can contribute, yeah, to spaces that are very different, difficult to research, but important for political geographers, that we at least to try to understand them. So yeah, this is the whole methodology kind of aspect. And then the security aspect of things was the debate about security gotten, or security scapes, like spaces where securities and insecurity happen, is very theoretical. It's a very theoretical debate. It's a lot of thinking, a lot of, yeah, just debating theory and security. And this contributed to this idea that, you know, security within critical academia becomes something negative. It becomes part of this whole neoliberal machinery. And I feel what gotten a little bit forgotten in the university context is that security is really the absence of insecurity. And that's good for many people. In the, you know, like, being secure is not a negative state. So we really wanted to kind of contribute a bit to this debate about security, insecurity, and what security means from, like, a grounded perspective, and have a look, what does it mean? What does security mean on the streets in, well, our case studies? And how does it work there? What does insecurity mean in our case studies? And, like, for, you know, something that never made it into the book, it's because it was quite difficult to write. But the first case study in Maputo, once James left, I outside the hotel we were staying, there was a man lying in garbage, and he had died of starvation. He was alive when I walked across him, or when I walked past him in the morning. I saw, hang on, there's someone lying. There was no ambulance to call. It was all privatized in Maputo. So I basically had to waltz into a 5-star hotel just next to USAID or USAID, the kind of center of this Mozambican success story of Mozambique becoming this neoliberal success story. And there was no first aid kit. There was nothing. The taxi drivers didn't want to drive the man to the hospital because he would make the car dirty. And it kind of shook me on a very basic level that, you know, we are doing this research in this so-called success story of, yeah, neoliberal success story. And there's still people just dying in garbage dumps because they have no food. And I never really talked about this in an academic context, but it shook me like really to the core. And I was like, okay, well, that's something to consider. You know, when I read the literature on Mozambique, that doesn't necessarily come out. So yeah, I kind of got drawn into the subject on an emotional level very early. And, you know, I assume we talk about, you know, what I did after the research. And it never really left me. So security from a very early stage, like my PhD research kind of was a very emotional topic to me, or insecurity and what it means. And the book was one way to intervene in that debate. Handing over to James, I guess.
I mean, there's a number of things to say there that, of course, my own time in Mozambique, you know, when I was a grad student, the war between Renamo and Frelimo, a complex war that had a civil war dimension as well as a regional dimension insofar as Ian Smith's Rhodesia and apartheid South Africa, you know, were protagonists, but then it became deeply embedded in Mozambique, and indeed its dynamics are still very, very active in the politics of the country. But that war was underway, so Maputo in many ways was kind of cut off from its hinterland, and travel across Mozambique was fraught. So I did move beyond. And the focus of the doctoral research wasn't on security itself. I mean, it was a study of kind of planning and urban geography, capital, space, power in Maputo in a kind of wider context. Of course, one could not avoid issues of security, but I did travel quite extensively in Mozambique, which meant moving with the Mozambican army. If one was out of the cities or moving between cities in convoys, some of which were subject to attack. So I had also this kind of very visceral experience moving through and encountering spaces of in a different register, in a more military register at that point, of security and insecurity. I mean, I just add that as a kind of another kind of personal kind of framing to that initial Mozambique work. But coming back to your question of kind of security escapes and just kind of picking up on what Till said, I mean, the literature on in security studies, critical security studies, different scales, is absolutely vast. Over the last few decades that go into the making of this book, that literature has proliferated. You know, it's in everything from international relations to kind of feminist studies. It's absolutely vast field, and impossible to entirely survey. Actually, we make some efforts in the book, but it, you know, as we point out, it becomes an impossible task. It would take actually many, many books to fully survey that field, and it continues to proliferate as well. But the scapes idea, of course, I mean, others had used the term security scape. So we are able to do a little bit of a genealogy of how others have used that term. But the scapes idea, of course, has been applied in other contexts. You know, there's a book on border scapes. There's work on consumer scapes, you know, hazard scapes. I co-edited a book on death scapes, spaces of death, dying, bereavement. And the idea, of course, is the scapes notion, you know, was popularized, you know, really around the end of the Cold War by Apadurai, Arjun Apadurai's Disjuncture and Difference in the Global Cultural Economy. And he, you know, he talked about ethnoscapes, mediascapes, technoscapes, financescapes, ideoscapes, with the suffix scape to indicate these aren't objectively given things, that these are relational things, that they look different from different angles of vision, that they are perspectival constructs, you know, that they're situated with different sorts of actors, that they're variegated, and that one can metaphorically and sometimes literally move through them. And hence this idea of the transect, which combines, you know, an old a geographical method, an ecological method of moving through space and mapping a phenomena. And so we kind of put these are the things that we put together, that, you know, drawing upon that scapes idea, and of course landscape, yeah, and cityscape, warscape, and we can go on. We can be here for many hours discussing this scapes literature, but we find it very, you know, very suggestive. You know, I mean, it invites empirical work, yeah, in different ways, and it invites for us as you know, embodied mobile men, able to move through space, and there's a whole, you know, gendering to this as well. It invites movements, walking, which is how and why we began that work in Maputo. And then, you know, eventually when it comes to Iraqi Kurdistan, the movement was actually more in vehicles. Yeah. We were walking as well. Yeah. And encountering checkpoints, and so on and so forth, these very material processes, you know, of how do you get from A to B in Iraq. You know, you will encounter a whole series of technologies of security and people that you have to interact with as part of one's process of movement, much as we do, you know, in many other sites and spaces, borders, and so on and so forth. COVID has multiplied all of this. And I think we also had this kind of interest in security guards, you know, and you know, the private security, the literatures on private security, but actually kind of, although the book isn't an ethnography of security guards, there are these kinds of numerous interactions with security guards who, as Till once said to me, have, you know, simultaneously one of the world's most boring and often lowly paid jobs, but also a job that is punctuated by occasional threats of dramatic action, which may be once in a career or never. But when they happen, suddenly the job acquires a whole another set of dynamics, which often relate to life and death. I think the other literature that I just mentioned very briefly is of course this idea of dispatches. Yeah. And you know, the dispatch idea comes partly out of war reportage and Herr's famous collection of, you know, of essays and dispatches from Vietnam, what we use as a kind of point of departure in the book. And then in turn, we look at some of the critiques of that genre, you know, its celebration of militarism, masculinity, its whiteness, its relationship to forms of American popular culture and their modes of exclusion and power. So we're kind of mindful of that kind of critique of not only Hearst's dispatches, but of the kind of wider genre of war reportage. And yet at the same time, we cannot avoid it. Yeah. At the same time, this is something that we informed in a way that her couldn't be by reading the feminist literatures and by our personal affiliations and connections. We can rethink or continually enact but problematize this idea of bearing witness and writing a dispatch on a place whilst recognizing that it is a particular mode of encounter and narrating place. So that's where the, you know, the other part of the title comes from. So we've got transecting, this method of moving through space. We've got security scapes with all of those literatures on security and the scapes idea. And we've got the dispatch, the notion of a contained piece of writing that bears witness to a moment and a place and draws upon, you know, a critical sense of a heritage of writing and reporting conflict and the limits of that genre, as well as its power. Yeah. And I think we go back to some of that in the chapter on Iraqi Kurdistan and right at the end of the book as well. But again, this is something we might come to.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. Thank you so much. That's very comprehensive. I think you lay it out really well, and not just the both of you, not just the getting into, you know, breaking it down what the book is about, but also I think the stakes. I think, yeah, those details from Maputo, I think really do get at that and highlight the importance of this kind of approach, what it can show us. So thank you so much for sharing all that. I'd like, as we round out the interview, I'd like to ask you, this is my personal curiosity, but also maybe useful for others considering embarking on a similar project in terms of the writing practice here. It's relatively uncommon, obviously, for sort of a book to be co-authored in this way. And so I'm wondering if you would like to share anything about how you approach that as a sort of writing process, you know, how you split up the duties or how that worked for you two, or if you've got any tips maybe for people considering sort of writing together.
Yeah, I think we've been writing the papers together, so it kind of started there. And I think most of the first drafts, we kind of spent time together. Like James moved a lot, I moved a lot, but we always found some time to kind of meet. The first paper we wrote in Amsterdam, I think, in James's apartment. I remember we wrote in Kurdistan in the place I was living. We always try to find time to sit together and talk things through. and then one of us would write a first draft and the other would add to it, and then it would go back and forth. I think the book worked because we did it on the smaller papers before, so there was like a mutual learning process. But James was also my PhD supervisor, so we had a fairly close contact. In this process, and it just happened. I think you know, two people need to be able to work together. Otherwise, it's very difficult process, and it kind of needs to click somehow. We never had any issues. We never had an argument about who is first author. We never had any issues about, you know, what goes in the book, what stays out. They kind of just work quite naturally and flowed. So I don't really have like a recipe on how to co-author. It just happened. It really just came together in our case. And we went with it. That would be my answer.
I mean, as Tiller said, places. The book is about places. Writing together in places was important. There were obviously periods when we didn't see each other for quite a long time, and you know, we'd be writing remotely, but it was vital to reconnect, and this reconnection, this work, you know, extending, you know, over a decade. I think also, till if you remember, you know, late on, at one point you came out again to Singapore, and we would go over to Indonesia, which also figures in the book, actually, in terms of, it becomes a kind of another story in terms of sites of security and insecurity in the Cold War and the events of 1965. There's also a kind of long kind of Cold War, post-Cold War story, you know, woven through the narrative of these three dispatches. These three sites, in terms of, you know, how they interact, you know, of revolutions and three revolutions and post conflicts and how they map onto a wider canvas of conflict at different scales, which cannot be reduced, you know, to Cold War, post Cold War. It has colonial, post colonial dimensions. It has all kinds of local and vernacular variants in terms of how these things are understood and continue to unfold in the three sites of the dispatches. But I think coming together in places, I mean, I remember, you know, very vividly when we were in the second time when I came to Iraqi Kurdistan, and your colleagues were always dragging us out. There was a great deal of hospitality and going places, and still saying, no, sorry, James has to stay in for the next, you know, few days with me, and just because we're sitting writing. And when you came to you know, Singapore, we went across to 20 plus kilometers away is Batam, Indonesia, and we kind of retreated there, which is also a very fascinating place to reflect from, given Indonesia's trajectory in terms of histories of security and insecurity. And although Indonesia was not part of our focus, it, as I say, it crops up in the book. So being able to spend time together from Amsterdam at the beginning to, you know, that time in Iraqi Kurdistan to quite late on. But there was also a time till when I couldn't contact you easily.
When I was
around 2015, yeah?
15, 16, 17, yeah. Yeah.
So I think it might be during that time we could have only some encrypted communications. And you want to say a few words about that? Because I think it's part of the story. And it's also part of the story of why the book took so long to finish, which I think enhances and enriches the book. And, you know, becomes, you know, the subject of reflection in its closing in the coda, The World Does Not Exist for Our Theories, where we have these methodological reflections and talk about other securities, you know, and we end up actually in Rojava, in Syria. I mean, this was a period when we couldn't work directly together. I mean, we could write at the end again. So I mean, it might be, I think perhaps important to say a few words about that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if yeah. So I mean, yeah. Me especially since the image is on the cover of Security Space, I don't think there's any getting around with it. I mean, a disclaimer: I wasn't too pleased that it made it to the cover, but the the publisher thought it's great. But 2014, 2015. I mean, as most people interested in security remember, ISIS came. ISIS made their appearance. Mosul fell. The Yazidi homeland of Shingal fell. There was a genocide, an organized genocide. I would compare to the Holocaust in terms of its total, like the whole quasi-state of the Islamic State was trying to restructure the ethical religious composition of at least Syria and Iraq. And I was there during the time. So eventually I went over to Syria, to Rojava, to the Kurdish revolutionary, feminist revolution, as an academic twice. To see what this revolution was about. And then eventually I stayed and joined the Kurdish Self-Defense Forces. So, I mean, Security States, yeah, it's kind of, we call it, I think we still call it participant observation, which is a very extreme form of participant observation. And I didn't obviously do it to later write about it. It was, you know, the whole region was in a state of emergency, geopolitically, politically. Everyone in the region was in a state of emergency. It wasn't quite clear what's going to happen next. If the Iraqi Kurdistan region is going to fall to ISIS, if Baghdad is going to fall, if Rojava is going to fall to ISIS, so it's really difficult to explain this period, and it's really difficult to explain what was going on during that period. But it's obviously, you know, having talked about security and the project being emotional, I mean, that continued in a very extreme way. And eventually I joined the Kurdish forces. There was like a rush of international volunteers, joining in particular the Syrian Kurds, and there were routes into Rojava, semi-legal routes into Rojava, which we took and joined the Kurdish militia. And that's where, and then, you know, going on, like, I fought 6 months and then went back to Europe for a short while, did some medical training, went back and then worked as a medic there, had eventually my own medic team. And then, doing the battle for Mosul, I was there, had a medic team doing that battle for some time. And it was very crazy time that really shaped my understanding of security. So we then sat down afterwards and kind of returned to Securityscapes. And obviously this experience heavily impacted, especially on the conclusion and how we assess the research we did so far. Yeah.
And there's a backstory there. I mean, in terms of, in the book, we both talk about Till is able to draw upon, that experience in terms of thinking in very embodied and, you know, visceral ways about security and insecurity, but also a critique of some of the kind of academic abstraction that we already talked about around security. You know, the idea that, you know, security is always a neoliberal, you know, state project, is always something that we should resist and refute. And a much more kind of nuanced sense of the multiple-sided signification of that, what it is to be secure and insecure. Mm. But the backstory is also, you know, the initial, you know, I talked about this idea of transect and, you know, drew upon a paper that I'd written in Plymouth before we went to do the work in Maputo. And that paper becomes a story that in which landscapes of militarism and kind of everyday forms of security and insecurity in that English naval city are told through a transect, and it's that we had in mind as something that could inform the kind of work that we would start doing when we went to Maputo. But that story also tells a story and is structured around the sudden death of my 10-year-old daughter, Jasmine Layla, who, without any warning, you know, picked up an infection at her school, at a primary school in Plymouth, and without anyone being able to do anything about it, and very suddenly, this very virulent infection that was circulating in between the public hospital in Plymouth and schools and care homes, and actually struck a number of other otherwise healthy young victims, including actually a young Marine. How this tragic loss informed the way that I could think about and what it meant to walk through the city, because I was writing about this walk that I'd done when Jasmine was alive, but sections of this walk and these places I'd been with Jasmine, you know, to play and to, as one does. And so there's that, there's kind of like, you know, at the beginning, although it's in the backdrop there, you know, there's that story of walking with and without my daughter, and how it informed, you know, my way of thinking and writing about everyday landscapes and forms of security and insecurity in the city. And that then crops back up, you know, as we say, in this conclusion, this coda, this closing chapter where, you know, Till, you say how we wrote. I mean, some sections of text are very obviously Till, yeah? And some are obviously me, and we occasionally move almost into a first person section. You know, and Till's kind of, you know, dispatch from, you know, scenes of conflict in Rojava, you know, are fed in there, and then we kind of link it back to my loss and stories, and then, you know, other encounters that we'd had in the places that we'd worked, and the whole kind of three-decade-plus story of what became the making of this book. But what it did do, that period when Till was in Rojava, our communication was necessarily limited. So I carried on working on the book. I had a sabbatical in Birmingham in England, and sat there kind of working through all the security scapes and critical security studies literature, because I had to kind of get that framing sorted out. Knowing that, you know, hoping that eventually we'd have the chance to reconnect and finish things off. But that was delayed, wasn't it, Till, really for a couple of years?
It was delayed for a couple of years. Yeah. But I think this, you know, if as you can see now, if we talk about security, it gets personal and emotional and quite dark very soon. And I think much of the literature doesn't, you know, it stays a very theoretical debate, and security isn't just theoretical. It gets dark, it gets emotional, and, you know, it has a profound impact on someone's mental and physical well-being. Like, this is what security and insecurity is about. So, and I think there needs to be a place in the literature for that as well, and in the debate.
I think we need
to remind ourselves, as you know, fairly privileged academics, that this exists. Like, this world, you know, it's out there, and we should acknowledge acknowledge these things, like, you know, debating security with a Syrian refugee family is a completely different debate to debating it in an academic context. And, you know, the two, I sometimes feel the two need to become more in sync again, which is a minor critique of the academic debate on the subject. But yeah.
I think having said that, we did feel, I was conscious and feel enabled by other work that enacts kind of similar grounded work, and you know, I guess as a kind of critique of the more abstract international relations notion of security, which is not new. I mean, critical geopolitics has done this, you know, for decades. And in a way, our book is partly also, you know, a contribution to or informed by critical geopolitics, but also I think enabled by the feminist literature, the repeated critique from feminist friends, family, colleagues, and the literature to say, hey, what are you talking about here, guys? Your way of knowing security is a very particular way of knowing security. There are other insecurities that cannot even be seen, do not constitute a visible, tangible scape, interior, or may be interior as well as manifest in a scape. So I think cognizance of those wider literatures, I think, gave us a sense of, well, we can find our voice and way through these, and we have, you know, a story to tell here that both connects with that literature, but is also deeply personal and experienced. And I think, I guess this goes back also to that notion, that genre of a dispatch as a mode of bearing witness. And we're actually talking more about this than we usually do. The two of us don't usually talk very much about this stuff personally, but now we're sharing it with New Books Network. I mean, yeah. it's in the book. But in the book, it's in a very compressed form, you know. I think it's. I have noticed. I've commented on this in the past with you, Till, that those who spent extended time in situations of combat, war, or in, as a combatant or as an observer, tend to talk about it in very, not to talk about it all the time. Talk about it in very particular ways, and I think that's what we stage in the book, actually. Yeah.
Mm.
And I think this has been commented upon many times. I mean, it's a you know, there's a great deal of reflection on this from journalists, for example, from combatants, ex-combatants, and I think that's also been true, you know, of our interactions. We don't, and indeed the way that we represent what we've done in the book. And I think it's very disciplined in the book. It's quite short. It's quite focused. But you can see how it runs through and gets folded through the three sites, the three dispatches, and how we kind of come back to it in the coda, in the closing of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. It does come through. And I mean, I feel very privileged to be speaking with you about those experiences in perhaps more detail. And I'm very glad that you've sort of shared those with me and with our listeners, because I think those kind of conversations around academic work are really important to have, right? Like that, you know, the way our own personal experiences play out. How we approach what we're writing about. So obviously, yeah, my comments couldn't possibly do justice to everything you've just brought up here, and I would love to hear more about it. Sort of reluctantly now, in the interests of keeping this under an hour, I'd like to turn to just asking both of you if there's anything else you would like to add before we wrap up, and maybe, you know, what's next for you both, or what you're sort of working on right now, if you'd like to share, that would be interesting for me to hear.
Yeah, sure. Well, so I have I have a book coming out in March as well with Casemate called America's War in Syria. And I wrote it with two guys I met in Rojava, two of my battle buddies, one John Fox, former US Marine, and Sean Murray, Royal Irish Regiment, British Infantry. And we basically use our personal story and what we observed and our personal story to communicate and to structure America's war in Syria. And it's not written for an academic audience. It's written for an interested public. And so there's a lot of, it's fairly easy. It's easy to read. You get kind of drawn into it. And in this book, it's the first comprehensive structure really of America's war, very shadowy war in northern Syria. And in the process, this book also talks about this whole, it picks up the debate about YPG, YPG, and their links to PKK. It picks up on the debate on what is Rojava actually about. So I'd say it's one of the first attempts to make democratic confederalism this inherently Middle Eastern version of democracy an actual political theory, because it is. It's lived by a lot of people. It's being implemented. It's being worked with. It's being adapted. It applies to different religious groups, ethnic groups right now. So I think, you know, the book also tries to move beyond this very, very silly, Öcalan had the idea, he's PKK, so it's about terrorism. No, it's not about terrorism. It's about gender equality and democracy. And so we're making this case, and this is now coming out. And while this is coming out, I've started working on a book on the YPG, the female force we fought with. So I'm plowing through the feminist literature on female fighters at the moment. And I have the distinct feeling that what the YPG actually does and what it contributes to the battlefield is completely missing from the debate. I'd say since in a very, very long time, the YPG is the first female force that didn't mimic men as a unit, but they fought as women. And that's why they were so effective. And that's why we can learn from them. So that's something I work on. And as you can see, like during my PhD research and my writing, my supervisors always said, "Oh, you're writing too journalistic. You're writing too journalistic." And I had to force myself to write academic. And now I write more on this journalistic first person perspective. And I enjoy it. And so that's what I'm planning to do in the future.
Right, thank you. James?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I in terms of, you know, field work, COVID, of course, which rapidly kind of rewrote situations of security, insecurity, the use of technologies and security guards. You know, another story kind of put an end to ongoing further field work. So you know, I had a project that would be building on work I'd done in the past in Arabia, that would be looking at Gulf cities, that would be looking at migrant lives. I'd done this work with Rabina Mohammed, who crops up in the book, because she's the mother of said daughter, Jasmine Layla. We've been doing this work for some years in Persian Gulf cities, and I started kind of extending this to the possibility of doing this in Mecca and Medina. That's had to stop before it could really start, because of COVID. So the hope perhaps to go back to some of that work. But I think one thing that, as many listeners will have found is that COVID has been, a time to sit and read and do theory. Because you cannot do the empirical work that you might have, or certain kinds of empirical work have been closed off. And I think there's always, perhaps this is a good way to close, there's always this interesting relationship between doing empirical work and a kind of wider theoretical arc. You know, and I've as a geographer, I've long felt, you know, as a discipline, this relationship, this tension, this dialectic, if you like, between theoretical work and doing very different forms of grounded empirical work is really quite important. And so I suppose now I'm in a time when, you know, because the kinds of grounded empirical work that I might want to do have been halted, hopefully to resume sooner rather than later, to kind of make more theoretical reflections. And you know, having got the book done, you know, I'm kind of, again, based upon really a whole lot of other readings and you know, personal connections, you know, thinking about and kind of also enlivened by the extent of energy around Black Lives Matter, around Black geographies, which is also crops up in the closing of the book in terms of connections with landscapes of security and insecurity in the United States itself, and the book kind of closes with that. Because that was very much in the news just as we were finishing it. You know, with all of those political, theoretical issues at stake, I'm kind of thinking through kind of what it means to kind of think about decolonial geographies and perhaps coming back, you know, to some of the issues that run through the book of post-colonial sovereignty, but also to kind of read decolonial geographies through the vast corpus of scholarship and practice that is Islam, yeah. Part of which, of course, is that necessary critique of Islamic State that Till was talking about. So this stretches my expertise, but the literatures are vast, fascinating, rewarding, and so I've been reading a lot of that work and thinking in terms of how that might inform a future book. But it will also be good to get back to field work, to get back to getting away from the computer screen and transecting space and place.
Yeah, I think we're all would all like to be back to that, right? Yeah, thank you both so much. I think. Yeah, I mean, very different projects that you're working on now, but those all sound fascinating. Maybe I'll get to speak with you about them on a future podcast. For now, I think that's a great place to close. So this has been Catriona Gold, me, speaking with Till F. Pasha and James D. Sidaway, who are the authors of the fascinating new book, Transecting Securityscapes, Dispatches from Cambodia, Iraq, and Mozambique, released in December 2021 with the University of Georgia Press. If you, listeners, would like to pick up a copy, please consider ordering directly from the University Press or supporting your local bookstore. Friends don't let friends buy from Amazon. Thank you all for tuning in to the New Books Network, and thank you again so much for joining me and for everything you've shared today, Till and James.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.